that at the top of Psalm 92, there is something that's easy to miss, and yet I think it's pretty significant for this psalm. It says, a psalm, a song for the Sabbath. Now, you can take my word for it. Otherwise, you have to actually leaf through and look individually at the other 149 psalms. But I want you to take my word for it. This is the only psalm out of 150 psalms in the Psalter that is associated with the Sabbath. And often if you read it, and that might strike you as a surprise, if you listen to what Ajunwa just read, there is no mention of the Sabbath in this psalm. There is no mention of rest. There is no mention of anything connected to this practice of the people of God throughout history, that one day out of every seven that we would rest from our work. Probably the closest you get in the psalm itself to anything here, kind of having something to do with the Sabbath, is in the first five verses, there are three references to God's works. And certainly that seems to be connected to the Sabbath, that in the beginning in creation, God works. He creates the world and then he rests. And yet many, many readers over the centuries and over millennia have often had a sense of, it seems a bit arbitrary and random that Psalm 92 is associated with the Sabbath. It doesn't seem like it has any more to do with the Sabbath than a lot of other psalms do. And so my goal today, as we spend some time in the Psalms this summer, is to help you to read this as a psalm that is particularly designed to help us do something that is always hard for all of us, I think, but especially in our culture, to stop, to rest, to actually disengage from labor and activity, not just with respect to whatever you do 9 to 5 or as a student, but just all of the things that we do in life where we are kind of in the rat race, where we're kind of doing something in order that something else would be accomplished or fixed or filled or whatever. And to rest, I think all of us, all human beings throughout history have a hard time resting, have a hard time stopping working in a fallen world. But our culture especially, and I think more and more, tends to create workaholics that don't know how to rest. I'm not going to mention who it is, but sometime in the last year or so, I did a sermon series on In the Wilderness. Some of you will remember that. It's been a while now. And I did a whole sermon on there on the Sabbath. If you want to get into some stuff on the Sabbath more than what I get into here, you can go back and listen to that sermon. And somebody came up to me afterwards and said, Nick, one of the things that I realized is that I know how to sleep, but I don't know how to rest. And I thought that was a really helpful distinction. That the rest is not just not being at work. It's not just being lazy or sleeping. It actually is its own posture, parallel to but different than work. And so the mystery is, why is this psalm connected to the Sabbath? I'm going to argue in a couple of minutes that the main way Psalm 92 helps us to rest on the Sabbath is it doesn't tell us how to do it. It doesn't teach us about what the Sabbath is. But here's the way I'm going to put it. If you are going to learn how to rest from your work, whether you believe, and I'm not going to get into it today, that Saturday is the Sabbath or Sunday is the Sabbath, or there's just a principle of work that two or three times a week you can just take off for 4 hours and rest, whatever you think, and that's always been a debate among Christians. It's not the point today, the topic today, but whatever it means to rest, and certainly we are called to rest and not just to work whenever that is and however that is. Psalm 92 doesn't teach us how to do it, doesn't teach us what that is, but here's what I think Psalm 92 is there are, every time you stop working, every time you enter into rest, you, if you know anything about yourself, you begin to feel uncomfortable. You begin to feel like maybe you're being irresponsible. You begin to get stressed. You begin to get worried. You begin to get bored. You begin to have all kinds of things that are pushing back on your ability to rest. And you'll notice, if you haven't already, that there are all kinds of obstacles, intellectually, emotionally, behaviorally, that begin to pop up that keep you from feeling like you can stop and rest. I think Psalm 92 is what you need to believe about God, about the world, about your place in it, if you are going to be able to rest. That is, Psalm 92 functions as a prerequisite for being able to rest on the Sabbath. I don't think it's accidental or random that it is associated with the Sabbath. A lot of you know this, that Shabbat, Sabbath, in Hebrew, literally just means stop. It means cease. Helen and Ernest and Taekwon and I live in a neighborhood in Queens, Regal Park, that is still largely Jewish, Bukharan Jews, the largest group of Bukharan Jews in the world, from Ukraine and north of Iran and Iraq. And every Friday night to Saturday night, every restaurant in our neighborhood Even Chinese restaurants and Italian restaurants, even Mexican restaurants, even convenience stores and bodega close because nobody is out doing anything. And so everything stops. And you will see signs in the winter. There's even one I have on my phone that there was a Jewish store that actually was a big deal that on Saturday night around 7 or 8 p.m. they actually would open. And they had a big sign that said, after the Sabbath, we're open. Because the two nights of the week that you most associate with going out and doing stuff in New York City, Friday night and Saturday night, all the restaurants are closed in our neighborhood. And even the Chinese restaurants and the Italian restaurants and the Mexican restaurants, they all are kosher. Because if you're not kosher, you're going to lose half of your business. And so we have this experience in the last year and a half of living in Regal Park that everything changes and everything comes to a standstill for 24 hours. And that is something that not just in the Western world in general, but even among Christians has just kind of, we've lost that. I'm not going to make an argument for, you know, what you do on Sunday and kind of Sunday laws and stuff like that. But there is a sense in which we have lost this. I would also point out, beyond the fact that the Sabbath is there, rest is there for our benefit, not to punish us, not to keep us from doing things, that one of the things that happens when we are relentlessly busy, always going, and a lot of people have pointed out that maybe one of the ways to think about what is distinctive about our world, our culture today, is its speed. That everything happens so quickly. Everything happens faster than it used to. And at the same time, because there aren't bumps in the road where we stop, where we kind of change our posture and we're just always going, there is also this sense that many of us have in the modern world. Now I'm old enough at 44. The internet came on my radar when I was in high school. I didn't have a cell phone until after college. I'm maybe one of the last generations where I remember all of my formative years before the rise of what's now kind of daily technology. And maybe it's nostalgia. I'm sure some of it is. I don't think most of it is. But I remember my childhood feeling so slow. And I remember my childhood feeling like there were differences between seasons and differences between the weekend and the week, differences between this and that. And often in the modern world, when everything is relentlessly fast and nothing ever stops, to use an old expression that I think is very insightful, modern people tend to experience the passage of time as just one damn thing after another. One damn thing after another. Season to season, it's the same. One of the reasons there's so much ennui and so much boredom and so much exhaustion and so much despair is because you don't have much of a sense that tomorrow or next week or next year will bring anything different than right now because we've lost rhythms. One of the reasons I am such a big fan of the church calendar is to give us a sense of rhythm, that time changes from season to season, from moment to moment. And one of the most fundamental changes, there is feasting and fasting, there's mourning and celebrating, but there's also working and resting. And if we don't have that rhythm down, we will really struggle to be fully human and to be the followers of Jesus that God has created us to be. And so two symbols from the ancient world that you probably know of that I want to bring up, and I'll come back to these later, that I think are almost patron saints of us modern people in the Western world. One is Atlas. The other is Sisyphus. Do you remember these guys from the ancient world? Atlas is one of the original titans who is overthrown by the Greek gods like Zeus and Poseidon. And he is doomed on the other side of losing this war between the gods and the titans. That he is doomed to having to carry the entire world on his shoulders. And modern people often have a spirituality, whether they call it that or not, of Atlas. That my work, I can't stop from it because it is so unbelievably important. Everything in the past has led to this moment where right here, right now, everything is at stake. Everything in the future to come will be determined by what we do right here. And we often have this sense that whether it's our jobs or our political activity or our social activism or whatever it is, that we have the weight of the world on our shoulders. Which is just another way of being a megalomaniac. And I always encourage people not to be megalomaniacs. On the other hand, and it might seem like a contradiction, on the other hand, we often feel like Sisyphus as well. Sisyphus is the guy who cheats death twice. And as a punishment, he goes down to Hades and he is doomed forever to roll a rock up a hill that afterwards is just going to roll back down to the bottom of the hill. He's got to turn around and do it again. And it's interesting that both Atlas and Sisyphus have been often adopted. Ayn Rand wrote a novel called Atlas Shrugged. Albert Camus wrote a philosophy book called The Myth of Sisyphus, that there's something about these two stories, these two figures, that illustrates what we struggle with when it comes to work, when it struggles, when it comes to time. And it might seem like a contradiction by itself to say that we could look at our work both as if it's the most important thing in the history of the world, like Atlas, and yet look at it despairingly as if it's meaningless. And yet I think as modern people, we often feel both of those things, that I have such a weight on me of what I do, it would be irresponsible for me to stop working. It would be irresponsible for me to stop engaging the world the way that I think I'm supposed to, because why? I'm Atlas, I have the world on my shoulders. And yet we often struggle with a kind of despair and a pessimism. No matter what I do, no matter what we do, we're just gonna die, and just all the problems keep reappearing and it doesn't actually do anything. I actually wanna argue by the end of today that almost the opposite should be true if you're a Christian, that you should see your work as deeply insignificant. If you were never born, the kingdom of God would be just fine. If I get hit by a bus tomorrow, the future is in God's hands and it's going to be okay. And yet you should see your work as meaningful, as having purpose. The opposite of these two figures. Our work, whatever it is, Psalm 92 puts the spotlight on God's work. And by the way, that's one thing I would say about the Sabbath right away. We do not rest because of our work, because it's finished or because it's adequate. We rest because of God's work. But it's also true that God invites us into his work. And if you're thinking, I don't like this rest stuff, it does feel irresponsible. Guys, there are six other days we get to work. I'm not saying just sit around, you know, resting all week long. I'm saying one day out of seven, we rest. And the other 6 days, God does invite us into his work, but we are not Atlas. We are not the ones who have the whole world on our shoulder. Eugene Peterson, towards the end of his life, said in his book, Christ Plays in 10,000 Places, I don't see any way out of it. After 60 years of being a Christian and 40 years of being a pastor, if Christians are going to live appropriately in God's creation, we must learn to keep the Sabbath. We must learn to rest. And so a couple of things about the Sabbath, and then we'll look at Psalm 92. Here's why rest is important. There's a sense in which you can tell the story of creation. You can tell the story of fall and redemption. You can tell the story of consummation, God healing everything in the future through the lens of work and rest. Front and center on the first page of the Bible, Genesis 1 to Genesis 2, 4, that's the first creation story, is God works for 6 days and then he rests from his work. And one of the things that story reminds us of is that we don't work or rest because the world is fallen. Both work and rest have dignity. When you work and when you rest, you are imitating the creator of heaven and earth. Both work and rest are good, and they are both participating in something that God has done first. And yet it also reminds us that we do not rest only, mainly, because we're tired after 6 days of working. Because if that was true, God himself would have no need of rest. Every culture in the history of the world, every group of people has to figure out how to both rest and work. If all a culture did was work, you would literally die. You wouldn't sleep. You would never have any time off. And if all you did was rest, you would die because crops wouldn't get grown and stuff wouldn't happen. And so every culture needs to understand work and rest. But the million-dollar question is, how do they relate to each other? It's for another time. I've done it in the past. A really interesting question to ask as you go through the rhythms of your life, working and resting, is to ask this very simple question. Do we rest in order to work, or do we work in order to rest? Every culture has to answer that question. And I'll give you real quick my sense of that. Ultimately, Christians need to say both of those things. Rest serves work, and work serves rest. But the really interesting thing about the Christian story is that I think we have to, at the end of the day, say we work in order to rest. Rest is the goal, not work. Work is a means to an end to rest. Once God creates the world, by the way, to illustrate this, years ago, many of you know, I talk about it a lot. For 15 years before I became the pastor here, I was in campus ministry. For my first 10 years, I was in Boston, mostly working with Harvard undergrads. And every once in a while, I would sneak in to a class called Introduction to Judaism in Harvard Yard, taught by John Levinson. Most people don't know who he is. Even Harvard students didn't know who he is. He's one of the most important Jewish theologians of the last 75 years. And every semester he would offer this class, 9 a.m., there would be like three undergrads there. And I would sneak in and I would take it. And I would just sit there. I think he was very appreciative that I was there. And it was just very interesting. And among the many things that stood out to me, I've learned a lot about the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, from John Levinson, is the whole class for a semester was Introduction to Judaism. This is what Jewishness is. This is what Judaism is. And I would always think, if any Christian, Catholic, Protestant, Eastern Orthodox, liberal, conservative, taught a class Introduction to Christianity, I can't think of a single Christian who would start the class like this. Day one, lecture one, Introduction to Judaism, Sabbath. He said, if you want to understand Judaism, you have to understand the Sabbath. If you want to understand God, you have to understand the Sabbath. If you want to understand what the world is for, you have to understand the Sabbath. And I actually think he's right about all of those things. The Sabbath and rest are central to who God is and why he's made the world. Another way that you can think about Sabbath and rest is that the entire story of fall and redemption is connected here. When we did this In the Wilderness theme, and we talked about how this paradigm of Israel was enslaved in Egypt before the Exodus, and then they're journeying through the wilderness for 40 years, and then they finally enter the Promised Land. And the Promised Land is always associated with rest. And over we talked about in that series how we're not slaves in Egypt anymore. If you're a Christian, you've already been liberated from sin and death. But we have not crossed the Jordan River yet. We are not in the new heavens and new earth. We are not in the Promised Land yet, which means we are in the same position as Israel in the 40 years in the wilderness. And I want you to think about one of the ways to distinguish between those three moments in the story: being a slave who hasn't been redeemed yet, being a redeemed people who have not entered the Promised Land yet but are journeying through the wilderness, and being God's redeemed people now in their home with everything having happened in the Promised Land. The main distinction between those three times and situations is work and rest. When Israel was slaves in Egypt, it was work 7 days a week, no paid time off. There was no rest in Egypt. It often even shows up in like hip-hop songs and rap songs today, but the prophets often say, no rest for the wicked, right? When we were cut off from God's grace, there was no real rest available to us. We were just working, trying to accomplish something that we sensed was lacking. Once Israel is in the wilderness, they work for 6 days, but they rest on the seventh. Once they go into the Promised Land, it's all rest, no more work. And in fact, with respect to consummation, the book of Hebrews, Hebrews 3 and 4, the book of Revelation, Revelation 14, and often throughout Christian history, this might blow your mind and it might even be a source of a bit of anxiety, but the life of the world to come, after God raises us from the dead, after he banishes the power of sin and death from creation, and he makes all things new, we will never work again. We will rest from our labors forever. So what is coming is rest. What God created in our origin was work followed by rest. If we don't understand how to rest, if we don't understand how to work and then how to rest, we don't understand our origin, we don't understand our destiny. In the Mishnah, a very famous Jewish document, on Psalm 92, the Mishnah comments like this. This is a psalm and a song for the era to come, for the day when everything will finally be nothing but Sabbath for eternal life. Sabbath is a picture of the world to come. It is a picture of what is coming. And if you think rest is just sleeping, if you think rest is just being inactive and passive, then you're going to have this conception of the life of the world to come that many religious people often do, which is that it's kind of a step down from this life. You're kind of sitting on a cloud playing a harp, and it's like an eternal church service, and there's nothing significant to do anymore. And if you are human, which you are, whether you admit it or not, whether you like it or not, is you will react with repulsion to that vision and put all of your hope in this life, because that's not what rest is. But rest is really important. And so the Sabbath is a gift to us, not a burden. Jesus says, and I would encourage you, if you struggle with rest, to have this in your mind. Jesus, you probably remember, gets into a lot of controversies over rest and over the Sabbath with the other Jewish leaders. And one of the things he says in critique of those who in his day had made the Sabbath primarily a burden rather than a gift, primarily a list of things you don't do, rather than something that you enter into positively, is Jesus says, remember, God made the Sabbath for human beings. He didn't make human beings for the Sabbath. Whatever rules you have for resting and whatever rules you don't have for resting, those rules are supposed to serve your well-being. You are not supposed to serve these rules for a 24-hour period of time. The Sabbath is a gift and not a burden. We imitate God on it. And just because I think this, in my view, is the most misunderstood part of work and rest. I want to say this real quick, and then we'll look at Psalm 92. The distinction between work and rest, between the other 6 days and the Sabbath, is not the distinction between activity and passivity. The distinction between work is not that you're being active, and in rest you're being inactive. Arguably, you can be just as active when you are resting, and many forms of work, especially in the modern world, but ultimately can be passive as well. The distinction between working and resting is not activity and passivity. And especially if you grew up in the church, I want to say this very clearly. The distinction between work and rest, the other 6 days of the week and the Sabbath, is not the distinction between secular and religious. Other 6 days of the week, you basically are secular. Be extra religious during these 24 hours. The Sabbath is there so you can pray more, so you can read the Bible more, so you can go to more church services. That is not what the Sabbath is for. The Sabbath is not a day to be extra religious. It is a day to stop your labor, to stop your working. You should be super religious the other 6 days of the week. Everything you do, you should do to the honor of Jesus and in his name. And on the Sabbath, you should be very secular in the sense we use it today. You should go on hikes on the Sabbath. You should go to art museums. You should have really good food. You should have good conversations with friends. You should listen to beautiful music. The distinction between the Sabbath rest and the rest of the week work is not between activity, passivity, being secular, being religious. Here's the distinction. It's the distinction between preparation and enjoyment. When you are working, you are doing one of two things. You are trying to finish or to complete what is still incomplete, or you are trying to fix what is broken. You're doing A, whatever it is, to bring about B. You're doing A to heal B. When you rest, you are just doing A, period, because it is good to be alive, and God made the world to enjoy these things. The difference between work and between rest is the difference between preparation and enjoyment. If you want to learn how to rest well, learn how to say no to every form of I'm doing A, comma, so that B comes about, which is why there are rules in scripture about make sure you don't have to like spend a lot of time preparing meals and like lighting a fire and cooking stuff. Try to stay away from activities where you're only doing it so that something else, that's what the rest of the week is for. Instead, do things that are intrinsically beautiful, worshipful, loving to God, loving to your neighbor, enjoyable for you, simply because it is good to be alive. One of the things that I think probably scares us, if we're willing to be ruthlessly honest with ourselves about the hope of eternal life, is at some point it's like, I'm going to get bored. And for a lot of us, I think at the heart of being a workaholic, which is true to some extent, I think, of every single one of us in this room, is that once we step aside from doing A so that B can happen, we often find ourselves being like, I don't know how to do anything else. I get bored really quickly. I get anxious really quickly. I don't really have any hobbies. I just know how to go back to work and complete things that are incomplete and fix things that are broken. And yet that is not the heart of being human. The heart of being human is worshiping and loving and engaging with God and engaging with our neighbor and engaging with ourselves and engaging with the world, because it is good to exist. And it is good that this world exists, and it is good that we have the time we have to enjoy what we have been given. Karl Rahner, one of the most famous Catholic theologians of the 20th century, said, every human being learns in the torment of the insufficiency of everything attainable that ultimately in this world there is no finished symphony. And so be the bearer of bad news before I get to the good news. It does not matter how much you work over the next 30 or 40 years. On your deathbed, there will be so much incomplete that you had hoped to finish, and there will be so much broken that you cannot fix. There is no finished symphony in this world. If you need to wait for a finished symphony to stop working, you will, like many modern people, never stop working, and you will just never rest. We don't rest because everything is finished, or because there's nothing broken that we could otherwise spend time fixing. We rest because this is why God made the world. This is not itself a religious sentiment, but I think there's something so powerfully beautiful here. On the Sabbath, if there's one word I would use to describe, what do we actually do on the Sabbath? What exactly is it about? I would use the word celebration. On the Sabbath, we celebrate the goodness of God. We celebrate his grace. We celebrate his provision. We celebrate that we exist even though we did not choose to. We exist that he's been faithful in the past. We celebrate that he will be faithful in the future. We celebrate that. A poet who I'm pretty sure was not a Christian, 1800s here in New York City, a lot of you have read him, Walt Whitman, has a great poem called O Me, O Life. And the first part of it, and a lot of you will have heard this before, the first part of it is him struggling with the sense of everything is broken, nothing is the way it should be, there's frustration everywhere I look, and then he has a great response. So here's the poem, it's very brief. O me, O life, of the questions of these recurring, of the endless trains of the faithless, of cities filled with the foolish, and of myself, forever reproaching myself, for whom more foolish than I, or whom more faithless? Of eyes that vainly crave the light, of the objects mean, of the struggle ever renewed, of the poor results of all, of the plotting and sordid crowds I see around me, of the empty and useless years of the rest, and the rest with me intertwined, this question, O me, so sad recurring, what good amid all of these, O me, O life? The point is he looks around and sees everything is incomplete and everything is broken. Nothing is the way, how can I ever feel like I have a place to stand? And then he says this, answer, that you are here, that life exists and identity, that the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse. Now that's ultimately too centered on us, but it is true, whether we work faithfully or we work unfaithfully, the powerful play will go on and you do exist and the world exists and it is good and it is to be celebrated. So one day out of seven, we stop, no matter how incomplete our labors are, no matter how broken things are in the world or in your life, and we just celebrate that we are alive and that God is good and that he is faithful. That is what rest is for. There is so much else I could say about it, but just want to say, we need to be people who know how to not just work, but to stop work and to rest. And so in Psalm 92, how does it help us rest? And I want you to notice that in Psalm 92, there are three things that occupy the focus of the writer, of the psalmist. And I think these three things, if you are anything like me, these three things in one way or another will function and probably already do as your primary obstacles to not being able to stop work and to be able to enter into rest. The first one is that we have this sense that the world, creation that God made, and let's define the world, let's define God's creation as both space, as an area where we live, but also time, it's also history, that the world, space and time, are chaotic, are unformed, and up for grabs. That is, that ultimately our activity functions to guarantee the order and the survival and the well-being of the world. Like Atlas, it's on our shoulders, and it would be irresponsible to stop working because then the future would be in doubt. Then what the world needs, which is my work primarily, would be in doubt. A guy named Michael Northcutt, it's at the beginning of the bulletin, has this line. And as I read this, I think, man, I think even many of us as Christians actually believe this. He says, time in the modern world seems to be in short supply. Modernity arises from the idea that the future is empty. It is up for grabs, and that collectively human beings make their own future and even the future of the planet. I think that that is central to the belief system of modern people, even religious people, that ultimately what comes in the future will primarily be the result of what we do or we do not do here and now. And I want to persuade you that that is not true. And if you hear that as saying, oh, that sounds really irresponsible, you're saying I should just go do nothing. Not other 6 days of the week, they really are for our work. But what our work never functions as is as the decisive pivot point between the disasters of the past and the secure future that we hope for. That is not the role that our work plays. And if you believe that ultimately it is our works, your work, that functions as the foundation of the stability of the world and the future instead of God's works, you will never be able to rest. And so Psalm 92 celebrates God's work as that which establishes the world, as that which is sustaining and ruling over the world right now, and as that which will in the future do whatever needs to be done to get us to his intended goal. And if you know that, if you believe that, here is something that you will feel. You will feel a great sense of relief that the primary burden for the well-being of the world is not connected to your work, because it's not. It's not. It absolutely is not. It is connected to God's work. Now, the two subheadings or the two kind of specific things in that is, if you break that down, what is it about the world that feels so fragile, that feels so unstable, that seems like it's so chaotic and unordered, and that requires my work, our work, to come in and guarantee that it goes on and to fix what's wrong and what would otherwise destroy it? And I think it's these two things that you see in Psalm 92. One is that so much is broken. Psalm 92 uses the language of evil and injustice. I don't want to pretend that this is easy. I'm 44 years old. I have spent a lot of time, and I still do, wondering about and worrying about nuclear war in the future, the effects of climate change, just all of the cultural and political and economic upheaval and anger and breakdown in our world today. I think about the fact that I'm going to die someday. I think about the fact that someday the sun apparently is going to burn out and the entire universe is going to fade to black. I think about these things. I just saw the Oppenheimer movie. I read that book. And let me say this very, very clearly. I do not think that you should rest because you have some utopian sense that because of Jesus, none of that stuff can happen. I am a pastor. I am not a futurist. Most of you are probably in a better position to know stuff about the future economically and in terms of military stuff. But I would say this, as a human being who tries to keep his eyes open, it's hard for me to imagine that in the decades and centuries to come, nuclear war, climate change catastrophe, and upheavals and economic political stuff, that there isn't really bad stuff coming. I think there probably is. I'm saying that even though there have always been terrible things since we fell into sin, and even though there are intolerable forms of injustice going on today, and even though terrible things will continue to happen until Jesus comes back, that it is not your work that constitutes the tipping point between whether that has the last word or not. And I want you to believe that. I want you to believe that. Because if you don't, you won't be able to rest. And I'll even just say this. And if you don't know how to rest, you will also not really know how to work. All of our problems are finally spiritual and moral problems. All of the solutions we really need are spiritual and moral solutions. Christopher Nolan, who I love as a director of this Oppenheimer movie, he has been saying a lot as he's made this movie that he thinks Robert Oppenheimer is the most important human being that has ever lived. There are a lot of reasons I think that's really not true. And Adam and I were talking about this. Do you remember this, Adam, at one point? Here's one. If Robert Oppenheimer had not led the Manhattan Project, at some point, whether it was 2 months later, 2 years later, 20 years later, we would have still discovered this technology. And we would have still been a culture that was unable to say no to anything that we are able to do. Robert Oppenheimer is not a particularly important human being in the history of the world. The fact that as a culture, we do not know how to work because, among other things, we don't know how to rest makes us a people that don't know how to handle these things that we are able to do. If we were a people who knew how to rest, to enjoy the world, to value what it's actually for, we would actually be more responsible in what we do. The solutions we need are not an extra 24 hours of working. The solutions we need are, among other things, being a people who engage work very differently the other 6 days because we know how to rest on this one day. And so if you feel like it would be irresponsible for me to stop engaging with injustice, to stop trying to fix what is broken, to stop trying to heal what is tainted, I would say what you functionally believe is that you play the role of God in the history of the world, and you do not. You can rest. The other one, and I think it's there for all of us, is not only does the psalmist say in verse 7, the wicked sprout like grass and all evildoers flourish. That the idea that people who are committed to evil and injustice, that injustice and evil seem to be doing really, really well. It is also true, and some of you have already experienced it in your own life. All of you have seen other people who are very good, very righteous, trust in God, love their neighbor, and the world falls apart on them. In suffering, is the righteous so often suffer. And so along with the fact that it often feels like injustice and evil and everything that is broken, if I don't stand up and do what is needed, nobody else will. If another group of people here and now don't do it, nobody ever will in the future up for grabs. We often think that if I stop working, my welfare and prosperity in the future will not be taken care of. Because even though I trust in God, I can't trust him with my future. And so the two things that tempt us to keep working is evil will not be dealt with, and the welfare and needs of those who trust in God will also not be cared for, are the very things that Psalm 92 goes after. I want you to notice something about Psalm 92. Besides the fact that even after in verse 7, it says all evildoers flourish, present tense, it says in verse 9, all evildoers shall be scattered, future tense. Part of faith is not just believing that God has already done certain things, the creation of the world, the redemption of his people. It's not just that he's doing things right now. Part of faith is trusting that he will do what he has promised in the future. And one of those promises is that he will bring an end to evil and injustice. That will not be your role. You might have a small secondary role in that, participating. And if you don't play that role, somebody else will, that God will raise up, but God will play that role. And at the end of the paragraph, Psalm 92, verse 12, the righteous flourish like the palm tree. They grow like a cedar in Lebanon. They are planted in the house of the Lord. They flourish in the courts of our God. They still bear fruit even when they get to old age. They are ever full of sap and green. And here's what the righteous know that the wicked don't. That the Lord is upright, that he is our rock, and that there is no unrighteousness in him. That the way that God rules the world is filled with wisdom and righteousness. We say that now, and when we get to the end of the story and we look back on history, and by the way, in case I'm not being clear here, I do not think Psalm 92 or any other passage of scripture is saying that we can trust this because we can see how it's going to happen. We have almost no idea what is coming in the future in terms of specifics, but we can trust that God will continue to sustain and guide and rule the world righteously, even as really bad stuff continues to happen. That the righteous, even though it often looks like they've been abandoned, even though it often looks like their future is really in doubt, that the righteous will never be abandoned. That those who trust in God, their future is always secure. And when you are struggling to stop your work and to rest, I want you to come to Psalm 92 and be ruthlessly honest with yourself and ask, do you believe these things? Do you believe that the future of evil and injustice will be overthrown by God? Do you believe that your needs and the needs of others who trust in God will be taken care of, and that the righteous will flourish, and that all evildoers will be scattered? Or do you need to still be a cosmic vigilante to fill the void that God is not playing in the world? And if you do, then you got another 24 hours of work in front of you on the seventh day. But if you know who God is, and so I want you to notice that Hebrew poetry, this is very rare, it is literally the center of the poem. There are 7 verses of 2 to 3 lines each, and then from verse 9 to 15, there are 7 more lines of 2 to 3 verses each, and literally the center of the poem is the unjust seem to be flourishing, the righteous seem to be abandoned here and now, but you, O Lord, are on high forever. But you, O Lord, are on high forever. He didn't just create the world. He won't just reappear at the end and just fix everything. Even right now, God is seated on his throne and he rules. This is the long view we need to take. This is the view from Mount Everest without which you will not be able to stop working and have the sense, both as Atlas, that everything is on your shoulders, and yet as the years and decades of your life go on and everything broken in the world is still broken and everything you thought you were going to finish is still incomplete, is like Sisyphus to begin to despair that you are just rolling a rock up a hill and accomplishing nothing. I would love to spare you from both of those fates. Psalm 92, I think, begins a series of psalms from Psalm 92 to Psalm 100. Would you keep your Bible open? Let's end with this. I want you to notice, and the next time you are, whether it's on Sunday, it could be today, it could be next Saturday, next Sunday, feel free to ask me to grab coffee with you sometime if you want to talk more about learning how to rest. Do I do it on a certain day? Do I do it multiple times a week? The main thing I would say now is just start doing something intentionally, where you protect and put a fence around, I am not going to do anything during this period of time, whatever that period of time is, where I'm doing A so that B, or I'm doing A so that C doesn't happen, and you just do A because it's good, because it's something to enjoy, something to celebrate, is read Psalm 92, and then keep reading and praying all of these. There is a theme that runs through Psalm 92 to Psalm 100. Look at Psalm 93, verse 1. The Lord reigns. That phrase will show up 7 or 8 times in the next couple of psalms. The Lord reigns. End of verse 1. Yes, the world is established and it will never be moved. Do you believe that? The Lord reigns. The world is established and it will never be moved. It's not saying that bad things won't happen, but the world has been established and it will never be moved or shaken because the Lord reigns. Psalm 94, O Lord God of vengeance. Probably a better translation is one who brings justice. The idea is not that he's responding in anger. The idea is that he's bringing to an end evil and injustice. O God of justice, shine forth. Rise up, O judge of the earth. You can trust God to do that in the future. You don't have to be a vigilante. You don't need to be a 24/7 cosmic policeman. That is not your role in the universe. It is not irresponsible to not deal with every single thing that has gone wrong and to stop working and to rest. It is irresponsible not to. It is deeply irresponsible not to. God is the judge of all the earth. Verse 12 of Psalm 94. Blessed is the one whom you discipline, O Lord, and whom you teach out of your law, to give him rest from days of trouble until this future moment when a pit is dug for the wicked, because the Lord will not forsake his people and he will not abandon his heritage, and justice will return to the righteous. These Psalms 92 to 100 are laying the foundation you need to know, and you need to be able to sing and celebrate if you are going to be able to rest from your work. Psalm 95. Verse 3, after it calls us to worship very famously in verses 1 and 2, verse 3, for the Lord is a great God, and he is a great king above all other gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are his also. It's where we get the phrase, the whole world is in his hands. Do you believe that? Do you believe that he is a great king over all other powers in the universe? Psalm 96. Verse 4, for great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods. All the gods of the peoples are worthless idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Verse 10, say among the nations, the Lord reigns. Yes, the world is established and it will never be moved. Are you getting the hint yet? All these themes dominate Psalms 92 to 100. Psalm 97, verse 1, the Lord reigns. Let the earth rejoice. Let the many coastlands be glad. Clouds and thick darkness are all around God. That is, I have no idea what his plans are. I have no idea how he's going to get us from here to there. How many disasters are coming? How many blessings are coming? All kinds of clouds and thick darkness you can't see through. But here's what you can know, that righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne. That whatever the plans are, they are righteous and just. And he's got the whole world in his hands. Do you believe that? Are you able to stop working and to rest and to enjoy here and now, even before we get to then and there? Verse 9 of Psalm 97, for you, O Lord, are most high over all the earth. You are exalted above all gods. Psalm 98, verse 6, make a joyful noise before the King, the Lord. Why? Verse 8, let the rivers clap their hands, even right now in the broken, incomplete present. Let the hills sing for joy together. Why? Because the Lord is coming. He is coming to judge the earth. and he will judge the world with righteousness, and he will set right everything that has gone wrong. Even right now, you can clap your hands with the trees. Even right now, you can sing with joy with the mountains, because the Lord is coming, and he is king, and he is judge, and you can trust him to be that. Psalm 99, verse 4, the king in his might loves justice. You have established equity. You have executed justice. Verse 1, the Lord reigns. Let the peoples tremble. He sits enthroned over everything that ever has happened, is happening now, and will happen in the future. And therefore, very famous psalm, but we often rip it out of context. The end of this sequence of psalms, Psalm 100, let me just read it. Make a joyful noise to the Lord, all the earth. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come into his presence with singing. Let the earth off your shoulders. You're not Atlas. Don't do it with drudgery and despair. You're not Sisyphus, just rolling a rock up the hill. It's not what your work is. Know that the Lord, he is God. It is he who made us. We have not made ourselves. We are not God. He is. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. He's the shepherd. He's the king. And so enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Give thanks to him. Bless his name, because the Lord is good. And his steadfast love endures forever, and his faithfulness to all generations. Do you believe this? Do you know that this is true? Let's end looking back at Psalm 92 with something that is really easy to miss. It actually stood out to me really for the first time this time as I read this. Madeline L'Engle, great 20th century Christian writer, it's at the beginning of the bulletin, has this poem where she says, "We cannot wait till the world is sane to raise our songs in joyful voice." Why are you still working? Why are you not resting yet? Because you're waiting for the world to be sane. You're waiting for the world to be completed. You're waiting for its brokenness to be fixed. You cannot wait for that to start singing. You cannot wait for that to start resting. You cannot wait for that to start celebrating. It's interesting that Psalm 92, it is very easy to hear this and read this, if you just read it quickly, as this is just this over-exaggerated posture of faith. But I want you to remember, in Psalm 92, the psalmist acknowledges that right now, all evildoers are flourishing, and the righteous often are hungry and suffering. And yet, in this broken present, look at verse 11. My eyes have seen the downfall of my enemies. My ears have heard the doom of those who are evil, of those who are unjust. That's partly what faith means, that we can see this already. We can hear it already. You do not need to wait. And that quote that I read from Michael Northcott, the future is not up for grabs. It is not primarily or only the product of what we do. It is already something established by God and guaranteed by his kingship. We can rest even right now because our eyes have already seen and our ears have already heard what is coming. You can rest. You don't need to be Atlas. You don't need to be Sisyphus. You really, really don't. I wish that I had remembered this ahead of time, although I love the songs we've sung today. There is an old hymn that I'll bet a lot of you have sung, a lot of you have heard, "This Is My Father's World." It's a pretty famous hymn. I'll bet a lot of you recognize it. You can go listen to it later on Spotify if you want. Here's the final stanza of "This Is My Father's World." "This is my father's world. Oh, let me ne'er forget that though the wrong seems oft so strong, God is the ruler yet. This is my father's world. Why should my heart be sad? The Lord is king. Let the heavens ring. God reigns. Let the earth be glad." That is a theology that you need to have to be able to rest, to be able to not be Atlas, to be able to not be Sisyphus. And so let me end with these two very simple exhortations negatively. Responding to those moments where we feel like we're Atlas, brothers and sisters, don't be a control freak. Trust in God. He reigns. You are a very insignificant part of this story. You are a creature, not the creator. And that is amazingly good news. Rejoice in that. Don't resist that. Your agency is not in the top 99.999% of what is going to happen to bring about God's future world. Don't be a control freak. And I would say for those of us more like Sisyphus, and ultimately we're all both, I would say this, and I think at this point in my life, I struggle with this one more. And I say this with all love, and like everything I say, I really do want you to know, I say this first and foremost to myself. I don't stand here as one who is above any of this. I would say this, guys, get a life. Learn how to be human. Learn how to find your identity primarily, not in your work and in what you do, but in being someone who is created in God's image, who is invited to participate in his kingdom, and who has an amazing future. Learn to diversify your portfolio. Learn to enjoy the world. Learn to step away from your work and to actually live primarily for something else other than your work. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, in the Gospel of Matthew, in the Gospel of Luke, when he's fighting the tendency towards anxiety and worry, among the many things he says is, what do you think your life is? Do you not know that your life is more than food and clothing and how much money you make next week? Do you not know that you are of much more value than birds and the flowers of the field? They are super lazy, they don't trust in God, and all of their needs are met. How much more so is your future secure? Your life is about so much more than what you do, and about how much money you make, and about the things you finish and the things you fix. And so I encourage you, as we go to the Lord's table, it is an ancient saying of the church, I'm going to say it as we go to the Lord's table, Christ has died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. He has the whole world in his hands. This is a day for celebrating. This is a day for putting down our labor and enjoying the world that he has made, because our eyes have already seen and our ears have already heard. The Lord reigns. The world is established and it will never be moved. You really can stop. You really can rest. And so let's pray and then let's go to the Lord's table.